The Missoula County Sheriff's Department has arrested two people and is on the lookout for another two in connection to the Clark Fork homicide investigation. That's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Good evening, I'm Conrad Scheid.
And I'm Corin Cates Carney. The Thompson River Complex fires have grown to over 800 acres. And Montana Public Radio's Christopher Allen speaks with a political science professor about what's next for Montana Democratic Party.
Two people have been arrested and two others are wanted in connection to the Missoula Sheriff's Department investigation into the death of Gilbert George Berry, whose body was found in the Clark Fork River this Tuesday. Officials say 27-year-old Kevin Joseph Lino is wanted for the charge of deliberate homicide and are searching for Angela M. Marchese, who was a witness in the case. Lino and Marchese are believed to be traveling in a white 2014 Ford Focus with a temporary West Virginia plate. The sheriff's office believes Lino is armed and dangerous. The sheriff's office arrested two other individuals in connection to the homicide investigation. One was charged with aggravated assault, the other for accountability for aggravated assault. Detectives believe that Gilbert George Berry, also known as Jack Berry, was assaulted, shot, and disposed of in the river. Berry was a 36-year-old man from Pennsylvania. A fisherman spotted Berry's body late Tuesday afternoon and led deputies to the river about 200 yards west of Grover Street. Search and rescue volunteers retrieved the body before it was sent to the Montana State Crime Lab.
In other news from around the state, the Thompson River Complex wildfires, which started in four areas in Lolo National Park, have merged into two fires and grown more than 200 acres since yesterday afternoon. The Cuckoo Scent and Spruce fires have spread more than 800 acres. The hot and dry weather, along with strong winds, have helped the fires grow since lightning started them on August 1st. The Cuckoo Scent fire is burning about 6 miles northeast of Thompson Falls above Highway 200, where the fire is visible to drivers along the Clark Fork Valley. Fire Information Officer John Hamilton says a public meeting was held last night at the Thompson Falls Community Center to discuss what might happen if the fire makes it down the Clark Fork Valley.
Yeah, we had a meeting. It wasn't real well attended. It was attended by officials mainly. There were a few interested individuals from that affected area, of course. But, they were there, and they are concerned about it. But, you know, I don't think they're overly concerned because it is a pretty controllable situation right now, really.
For firefighters, this steep, rocky terrain can be challenging to work, but Hamilton says the fire doesn't pose an immediate threat to homes or structures on the bottom of the valley.
Unless we got a freak wind, it probably wouldn't ever be bad, you know, because it's going to, moving downhill, fires generally don't make that bigger runs. They just kind of throw a cone out and it rolls down the hill, starts a fire, burns back up to the old fire. It's not a real active fire on that edge right now. So, you know, it's moving pretty slowly down towards the valley floor.
The Thompson River Complex wildfires are currently being manned by 173 people.
You know, you compete for resources when you got other fires in the area going, and we do have some, like over in Washington still, that are kind of competing with us. So we will get what we get and go with that.
As we've reported throughout the week, helicopters and air tankers have dropped water and flame retardant while crews build fire lines by dropping from helicopters into rugged, steep terrain. Forest officials have closed down road number 603 and all roads that feed into 603 and the West Fork of the Thompson River drainage. The Cuckoo Scent Trail and Big Spruce Trail remain closed because of safety concerns.
A 38-year-old Missoula man faces felony charges after a Helena man said he was kidnapped and robbed when he traveled to Missoula to buy marijuana. Daniel James Fox was arrested shortly before noon on Monday after police chased him through a city park. His scheduled appearance in justice court on kidnapping and robbery charges was postponed Wednesday because officials said he was still under the influence of drugs. Court records say Sergio Grimán told officers when he arrived at the location to buy marijuana early on August 4th, Fox and others were smoking meth and being crazy. He said Fox ordered him into his car, put a gun to his head, and robbed him of $200 and a cell phone before letting him go and driving off in the car. Fox was jailed yesterday on $250,000 bail.
State wildlife officials are reviving a plan to issue elk kill permits to landowners in parts of southern Montana to reduce the spread of disease to cattle. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks commissioners yesterday gave initial approval to the plan for the 2014-2015 season. It would allow up to 250 elk to be taken by permitted landowners and hunters during the special dispersal hunts. The aim is to keep infected elk away from cattle to prevent the spread of the disease brucellosis. The final vote is expected in October. Commissioners agreed to issue any of the permits last season after two hunters groups filed a lawsuit in May. The lawsuit from the Skyline Sporters Association and the Anaconda Sportsman Club remained pending before the state judge, Mike Menahan, in Helena.
The Commissioner of Political Practices says 26 candidates for state and local offices face removal from the general election ballot if they don't file campaign finance reports by next Wednesday. Commissioner Jonathan Modell issued his decision today in a complaint filed Monday by Bowen Greenwood, the executive director of the Montana Republican Party. Greenwood complained that Democratic State House candidate Steve Hochland of Billings had not filed any campaign finance reports and asked that Hochland's name be removed from the ballot. Modell found a total of 16 legislative candidates and 26 local government candidates had failed to file. After receiving notice of Greenwood's complaint, 14 candidates filed reports. That leaves 11 legislative candidates and 15 local candidates who have not filed by noon today. Two other candidates have said they plan to withdraw from their races.
Montana Democrats are casting a ballot for a last-minute U.S. Senate candidate to take on Republican Representative Steve Daines after their chances of winning in November suffered a huge blow with the withdrawal of incumbent Senator John Walsh. Montana Public Radio's Christopher Allen spoke with political science professor Robert Saldine to find out who could replace Walsh and what's next for the Montana Democratic Party.
I'm speaking with Robert Saldine, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Montana and the Director of the Project on American Democracy and Citizenship. Thanks for talking with me today, sir.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
As you know, after the New York Times broke this plagiarism story, Senator Walsh has been under a lot of pressure to drop from the Senate race, and he did say on record that he didn't plan to drop. Were you surprised by yesterday's announcement?
No, not really, Chris. It had started to feel like something of a death watch over the last several days. Walsh had canceled a number of campaign events. He'd quit talking to the media. There'd been a pretty devastating poll released early in the week that showed over 60% of voters said that they were less likely to vote for Walsh. That's pretty damaging. There were some major editorials in the key newspapers around the state last week calling for him to resign. So all these things were piling up, and there was a clear sense that the damage done to the Walsh campaign was irreparable, and that it was probably time for him to step aside.
So going forward, the Montana Democratic Party says they're in the process of scheduling a nomination convention as soon as possible. This seems like kind of a unique event. Can you give us a little context here?
Well, sure. It's fascinating for political junkies because it is a novel thing. I mean, we really just don't see this in Montana very much. In this instance, you're going to have the real elites of the Democratic Party, the party leaders. You know, about 175 people who are going to be choosing the nominee instead of the people, which is, of course, how it works in the primary. So this will be something of a brief return to the old infamous days of the smoke-filled rooms. And so one of the implications here for people who are hoping to get the nomination at this point is that it's a different game than you have during the primaries. In the primaries, you have to be out there courting the voters. Well, this is an insider game with the party elites. So it really does change the dynamic.
I'm speaking with Robert Saldine, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Montana. So former Governor Schweitzer, he said, not interested. Governor Bullock isn't interested. The layperson out there, who's a possibility here?
Yeah, well, there are obviously a lot of people who've said they aren't interested, but there are a number of people who have indicated interest, and I think you can conceptualize it as three different groups. The first group would be the also-rans from the primary that Walsh ended up winning. Those would be John Bollinger and Dirk Adams. All indications are that both of them would be delighted to be the nominee, and they might have some claim to it because, after all, they did throw their hat into the ring the first time around, and Bollinger finished second in that primary. So I think you got to look at him as a especially strong potential nominee. The second category would be some new names that have popped up. The two names I've been hearing most are Dave Wansenried and Frankie Wilmer. Wansenried has been in the legislature for a long time from the Missoula area. Wilmer is also in the legislature from Bozeman. She's a political science professor at Montana State. And so, again, both of them seem to be eager for the nomination. And then I think the other group you could throw in there would be some of the big names who have indicated that they aren't interested, but perhaps with some pressure from the party, maybe they could be convinced to change their mind. Obviously, Brian Schweitzer would be the big catch there. He would be the person who would have the best chance of beating Steve Daines. But in addition to the names you mentioned, you could also think about someone like Pat Williams or Carol Williams. Carol is, like the others, indicated that she's not interested, but you never know.
Well, whoever it is, they're going to have a tough time getting momentum. Does anyone really, other than maybe some of those big names, does anyone really have a shot of beating a popular and well-funded Steve Daines?
Yeah, it's going to be awful tough, Chris. The fundamentals here always favored the Republican candidate. It's a midterm election, which typically favors Republicans in terms of turnout. You have a sitting president, Barack Obama, who's a Democrat, who's pretty unpopular these days, especially in Montana. So even before you know who the nominees are, it doesn't look very good for the Democrats. So it's very daunting. And, of course, now you have less than 3 months before the election, and you're starting from square one with no money, no campaign infrastructure. Some of those things you can get up and running pretty quick, but things like the money, that takes a lot of time. So it's going to be a real uphill challenge for whoever the nominee is.
Robert Saldin, thank you very much for giving me a few moments of your time today.
Hey, you bet. Thanks, Chris.
In breaking news, Democratic Party officials have just announced they'll hold a special nominating convention August 16th in Helena to select a replacement candidate for Senator John Walsh in the U.S. Senate race. The convention will start at 9 a.m. in the Lewis and Clark County Fairgrounds. Party spokesman Brian Watt says the intent is to have a candidate nominated by the end of the day.
Rangers have not been able to spot the unmanned drone that crashed and sank in a hot spring at Yellowstone National Park last weekend. Park spokesman Al Nash says Rangers are considering using a helicopter to see if they can spot it from the air. Even if they find it, Nash tells the Jackson Hole News and Guide that it's not known if the drone can be removed from the Grand Prismatic Spring. The Grand Prismatic is the third largest hot spring in the world and is up to 160 feet deep. It's known for its vivid colors. A drone expert says he has concerns drone materials could harm the hot spring. Nash says no decision has been made on citing the drone operator, who notified authorities of the incident.
Tainted Revelations, The Art of Bill Orman, is a book that offers people a chance to see images of Orman's paintings and sculptures. Sheree Newman, producer of The Right Question, talked with the book's author, Joe Ashbrook-Nickel, about the 95-year-old artist.
I think it's a really kind of inspiring story for a lot of folks to look at this guy who, you know, at the point at which he retired, he also kind of gave up worrying about what other people thought of his views, and he started being more bold and honest about how he views the world. And I think that that powerful honesty comes through in his work in a way that I think will resonate for generations to come. That's why I felt this book had to happen ultimately, is because I really do feel like this is work that 50, 100 years from now, people will still be looking back on as both a reflection of what was really going on in our time and views of history and the future that are very compelling.
There's so much to think about in each one of the paintings, and I just have an idea of somebody having this book available at a party, and you would just have endless conversations going on just looking at two or three of the paintings.
Yeah. I have a 7-year-old son, and I've had great conversations with him about this work. When I first gave him a copy of the book, I was picking him up from his sitter's house, and I had just gotten my first copy, and I handed it to him, and he was sitting in the back seat looking at it, and he said to me out of the blue, "Dad, there's a lot of violence in his paintings." And I said, "Yeah, there is that." And then just a second later, he started giggling about something. I don't even know which painting he was looking at. There's that wide range both of content but also tone of these works. There's great humor in some of these paintings.
He and his wife, Phyllis, have built a museum, which, as a sign says, is usually open.
That's right.
So if a person wants to go there, they get themselves to Drummond, and then what?
Just head straight south on Highway 1 toward Hall, and there on the right, you'll see the Bill Orman Museum and Gallery sign, and usually open is on a barn next to it. And if you pull in the driveway, if they're in the farmhouse, at least one of them will usually come out and walk you through the gallery, and you can spend as much time as you want to there. The best part about doing this book is how much time I got to sit with them and sit in their gallery and just look at that art. And I swear to you, I've been out there 40, 50 times at this point. And the last time I was out there, I walked in and I saw a painting and I looked at it and I said to Bill, "Is that a new one?" And he said, "No, that's been there for years." Because there's just so much to look at. It's like going to the library. You could go there over and over again and find new stuff.
Joe Nichols' book is available at the Orman Museum and Gallery, in area bookstores, and at the Missoula Art Museum, which is currently showing an exhibition of Bill Orman's paintings and sculptures, including a woolly rhinoceros.
The forecast tonight calls for cloudy skies across our listening area, with a chance of rain in central and southwest Montana and lows in the mid-40s and 50s. More clouds and intermittent showers are expected over the weekend, with highs around 80 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Anderlich.
Everyone would like to see Missoula get more good jobs, jobs that pay well, offer good benefits, provide access to quality health care, and a secure retirement. Most people will say that the particular good jobs Missoula needs are in the high-tech, manufacturing, natural resource extraction, and construction sectors. Indeed, jobs in these sectors tend to offer workers more of the very things that define a good job. In fact, these jobs, manufacturing, natural resource extraction, and construction, were the bad jobs of 100 years ago. Back then, these jobs were dangerous and low-paid with few, if any, benefits. So how did the bad jobs of 100 years ago become the good jobs of today? By far the most important factor was the labor movement. It was the decades-long struggle of organized workers in these sectors that turned these bad jobs into the good jobs of today. The labor movement had help. Churches, worker-centered political parties, politicians dedicated to social and economic justice, and other civic organizations. But it was the drive of workers organizing for change that was the principal force. A few statistics. University of Montana economist Larry Swanson estimates that about half of all new jobs in Montana by 2020 will be in retail, hospitality, and healthcare. About 36% of all Montana workers today are employed in these service sectors. In Missoula, according to the Montana Department of Labor and Industry, about 36% of all Missoula private sector workers work in jobs that pay on average less than $23,000 a year. In particular, over 4,400 Missoulians work in about 250 food service establishments where each job pays on average $12,706 a year. Typically, these service sector jobs offer few, if any, benefits, difficult access to quality health care, and no real security for retirement. About a third of low-wage workers in Montana do go on to, quote, better jobs, according to the Department of Labor and Industry economist Aaron McNay. He also says that another third are long-term workers in the service sectors, and the rest have both a service and a non-service sector job. The National Women's Law Center has found that nationally, one-third of women in the low-wage workforce are mothers, and 40% of them have family incomes below $25,000. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, half of all minimum wage workers are 25 years and older. These jobs are clearly jobs not dominated by teenagers. These jobs are the bad jobs of today. The work that these workers do deserves all of our respect. It is real work and a real job. Service sector workers need a good job to support themselves and their families. So what can be done? Just like the labor movement of 100 years ago, it is up to workers in these sectors to find their voice and their power to transform their jobs into good jobs. We will need to find allies like workers a century ago, religious institutions, political leaders committed to social and economic justice, and other civic-minded organizations. But, as it was back then, organized and organizing workers will need to be the principal force for change. The movement is already at work here and around the world. The campaigns of Walmart and fast food workers are but two examples. Here in Missoula, two campaigns seek to turn service sector jobs into good jobs. The Missoula Community Benefits Coalition is working to make the proposed Hotel Fox and Convention Center a project that addresses some of the vital needs of Missoula. These include providing good construction jobs and giving hotel workers a chance to organize and find their voice to make their jobs good jobs. Another campaign is the Good Jobs Missoula Project. This effort seeks to engage and empower low-wage food workers across the city. Since the program's launch, Good Jobs Missoula is working with Missoula's food workers, developing their leadership capacity to build a citywide movement of low-wage food workers. Participants will direct the campaign to improve their jobs, and Good Jobs Missoula is developing community allies for support. These and other efforts will be needed for the challenging work ahead. Just as organized workers over the past century developed the middle class by turning bad jobs into good ones, we can again prosper as a people by the transformation of service sector jobs into good jobs.
Mark Anderlich is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Corin Cates-Carney.
And I'm Conrad Scheid. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.